I'm Annette Rowland, and I'm an administrator for a home for mentally retarded adults in Minneapolis. And I'm also a speech therapist by profession, so I've done some direct care kinds of things as well as administration for mentally retarded. And what I kind of wanted to talk about and hope we can get some discussion going is sort of what's happening in the world today, politically and socially, around the issues for mentally retarded and physically disabled. And because it's what I'm most familiar with, I'll tell you a little bit about what's going on in Minnesota. Minnesota has licensing laws for small community-based settings for both physically disabled and mentally retarded. And I think there are some laws now in other states covering physically disabled, but Minnesota's law was one of the first that actually set aside separate licensing for facilities for physically disabled adults that are not nursing homes. They're not part of the whole health-oriented setting of a nursing home. They may have round-the-clock nursing, but they're designed to be a home instead of the sort of almost hospital-like setting.
More like a residential care center.
Yeah, yeah. And Minnesota really has sort of been a leader in a lot of these areas, but really with the physically disabled, started trying to set up some places to get them out of the nursing homes and out of the state institutions and into community-based settings. There's also licensing for mentally retarded non-physically disabled people. So you can have settings for physically disabled who are not mentally retarded, a combination of mentally retarded, physically disabled, and then for mentally retarded people who don't have other physical disabilities. And there's a real push to kind of have specialized facilities for those different populations, and rather than trying to everybody serve everybody at once. There's also some new legislation and regulations on something called semi-independent living facilities, which are facilities where there would be staff, but not necessarily round-the-clock staff for either mentally retarded or physically disabled, so that they would have some assistance with financial things, maybe with shopping, with some other kinds of things, but they could live in individual apartments, five or six people in a house together, without staff necessarily there overnight, by their own house, if you know they had money to do that, and some of those kinds of things. So there's a real push in Minnesota as well as nationally to get what are called normalized living settings for the mentally retarded and physically disabled. There are a couple pieces of court order type things that are pushing that too. There's a Pennhurst class action suit, a class action suit against the large institution in Pennsylvania called Pennhurst. And in that class action suit, the court decree came down saying that there was no way that adequate services could be provided to mentally retarded in an institution. By its nature, it was inadequate, and that people had to be moved out of it. That's sort of been backed off on by some things that have happened in the Supreme Court, but it's still pretty much a valid court order. Partlow in Alabama had a similar class action suit against Partlow and got the same kind of a response, that by its nature, the large institution is inadequate and cannot provide good services. Minnesota also has a consent decree on getting people out of institutions called, well, it's had a variety of names, but Welch versus Newt is its current one, because it's against the Commissioner of Welfare in Minnesota, and so Newt is the current one, and he gets named in the decree. A couple of other people have had that honor before him. And in that decree, we have to place 600 to 700 people in the next 3 years back in the community. Hopefully we can move people on into these semi-independent settings to some degree and not have to build all new, but we do have to build some new facilities.
Placing them, you mean out from out of the institution or out of nursing homes?
Out of the institution.
Oh.
That doesn't cover people. The 600 to 700 people are not in nursing homes and they are not in their own homes in the community now. They're in the state institutions. And of course, the people who are left in the state institutions at this time, pretty much nationally, are the severely retarded and the severely multiply disabled, people that have a variety of problems. So there's that push on one side to get people out into the community, to get them into more normalized services, to have more opportunities for them educationally, and work opportunities as well. On the other side of the coin, there's a large push, both federally and statewide, in almost all of the states now, to cut costs. There aren't very many states that are in a position to have a lot of money. Minnesota, which has always had good funding for social services, is hurting across the board and in everything, in education, you know, just in every area. And basically what's happening then is that social services are being cut too. Federally, Reagan is saying, you know, volunteers ought to be able to do it. We ought to be able to cut costs in medical assistance. Social Security is going broke, so we've got to cut out, you know, we've got to make Social Security more efficient. We've got to do some things there. And, of course, we need more money for bombs and other kinds of things. My bias is showing through pretty strong. But and most of the people working in social services fields would agree that we probably can save some money in some areas, and that the unending stream of money is rapidly going dry, and it's just not there, and that we're going to have to start cutting back. We're going to have to start being more cost efficient, and we're willing to do that, but not at the cost of the health and safety of our residents. And this is where the push and shove kind of comes. One of the issues that happened with medical assistance within the last year, the last budget legislation, was that there was this proposal, and it was pretty widely thought of till some people started writing letters and saying, wait a minute, this isn't going to work. The proposal was that medical assistance people who were collecting medical assistance, would have to co-pay for doctor's visits. So they would have to pay $1-$2 per visit to when they go to the doctor. Well, on the surface, that sounds wonderful. We say, well, all these poor people out here, you know, they just run to the doctor for anything. They don't care, you know, and that's what's costing us so much money. And that's the argument that a lot of people make. Well, the problem is that the bulk of people on medical assistance, or a very large percentage of them, are children who have no income and have no way of getting income. They can't go to work. Or they are the elderly, the mentally retarded, and the physically disabled, and a lot of that population, those three areas, are in residential facilities. And in the residential facilities, the government says how often you go to the doctor. You must have an annual eye exam. You must have an annual ear exam. You must, if you're a skilled care patient, you must see the doctor every 30 days for the first 90 days you're in a nursing home, and every 90 days after that. If you're an intermediate care patient, you must see the doctor at least once every 6 months. If you're in an MR facility, you have to have a complete physical at least once every year, and you have to have medication reviews every 60 or 90 days, and you have to have this, and you have to have that. And there's this whole list of regulated doctor's visits. Also, for these people in residential facilities and on medical assistance, their income is regulated. They are only allowed a certain amount of discretionary income. In Minnesota, that's $35 a month. So you say, you know, the government says you can only have $35 a month or whatever it is in each state. You must go to the doctor this many times a year, but you've also got to pay for those visits out of your $35 a month. Doesn't add up, doesn't make a lot of sense. That a lot of people wrote letters about that, a lot of people had some strong feelings about that, and that particular issue is dropped for the moment. It'll probably come back up. It's just not fair. And that's just one of all kinds of things. They've taken out a whole list of medications that people have been used to having. Milk of magnesia can no longer be paid for by medical assistance for patients except in some very unusual kinds of circumstances. None of the laxatives, none of the bulk producing kinds of medications that a lot of elderly and physically disabled people are dependent upon almost for their very lives, because without those medications to keep their system working, they just don't work, and then they get all kinds of additional medical problems. So in one sense, we're really being penny wise and pound foolish in some of the medical assistance kinds of things. There's just a lot of other, you know, those are just a couple little examples of some things that are going on and some kinds of things that are happening in the system. There's as well as the idea of decreasing the amount of money that's available for social services, there's been no push and not even any indication of any push to decrease the number of regulations placed upon us. In the facility that I work in, we have 5 or 6 different state and federal inspections per year. And that wouldn't be so bad. I know we need to be inspected, and you know, it's important that we're inspected so that we keep on our toes and keep doing things that are legal. The interesting thing is that they come within 4 months period of time. So as long as we're nice and good, you know, if we really wanted to be awful, we could be nice and good and legal for about 3 to 4 months, and then we could be rotten the rest of the year, and there's not a whole lot that would ever happen to us. You know, we really can, we could cut staff, we could serve not as good food. You know, there were a lot of things that we could do and probably never get caught at. The particular facility that I work at, I've been there 11 months now, and it's been in operation about 10 years, and it's made a real commitment to year-round excellence. That's not necessarily true in every facility. There are a lot of facilities that get pushed by the dollar bill. They start running out of money somewhere along the line in the year, and so they start cutting corners. And sometimes those corners can be dangerous, but because of the way the system is set up and the way, you know, you're licensed for a year, and then very seldom do the licensors come back in between, you know, you can get by with some of that kind of thing. And it can be real dangerous. There's just some crazy kinds of regulations. The facility that we have does not admit anybody who is non-ambulatory, anybody who is blind, anybody who is, we have one deaf client, but we probably would not admit any more. But we, up until this year, we have had to write special petitions every year to ask that the parts of the regulations be given a waiver for those things that are required for physically disabled. We're not licensed for physically disabled. We can't have them there, but we've got to ask special permission not to have ramps and not to have elevators and not to have doors marked for blind and not to have audible and visual things like fire alarms and doorbells and telephones. And I mean, you know, there's just all kinds of crazy rules that go on. They come in and, you know, look at everything, every corner. And that's fine if you're looking for cleanliness or looking for animals or, you know, something that aren't supposed to be there. But if there's a piece of scratched paint on the door, you get a deficiency order to paint the door. You know, even if it was painted yesterday and a client kicked it, you know, and could have knocked a piece of paint off of it, you know, you still get an order to repaint the door. And if you don't, you can get fined. So there's a lot of regulations that I think could be looked at with some logic and some sense that would help us cut some costs. You know, if cost cutting is what they want, then, you know, we need to do that. There's some other things happening in Minnesota, particularly because counties are being cut with money, that what they're doing is sort of robbing Peter and hoping that we can pay Paul out of the other pocket, because we're required to have our residents out in day programs every day, 6 hours a day. The residents must be out in the day programs. Well, the counties pay for day programs in Minnesota, and the state money pays for residential programs. So counties, because they don't have enough money, are cutting back on day services and cutting down on what people can do, hoping that the residences who get their money from the state are going to be able to get a little more money. But last year there was a 10% limit on our per diems put into effect for nursing homes and all residential facilities, so we could only get 10% more. So essentially what was being asked of us was that we maybe provide one-third to one-half again as much service as we've been providing on a 10% dollar increase over the year. Those are the kinds of things that are causing just some real hassles for us and are going to then cause some problems for the mentally retarded and physically disabled in just being able to live a good, normal kind of life. And the idea that volunteerism can pick that up sounds wonderful on the surface, but there's so many pressures on that volunteer time and volunteer dollar. The poor are just, you know, and the poor, the population that's considered poor is getting bigger and bigger with the unemployment. So there's a real pressure for dollars and time by the poor. The churches are wanting the dollars. I mean, their expenses are going up. They need the dollars. The arts aren't getting the federal money and the other monies that, you know, were there before. So they're asking for the volunteer dollar. And particularly the mentally retarded don't have very many spokespersons. The physically disabled oftentimes do, because many of them can be their own spokesman. The mentally retarded really cannot adequately speak for themselves, and they don't have a whole lot of groups wanting to speak for them. So there's a real push comes to shove kind of situation going on right now. And, you know, I guess my goal was just to sort of inform and enlighten and open it up for some questions and discussion. So got some? Let's go at it.
The statistics or any of the information at my fingertips for Oregon as you do for Minnesota. I do know that in general Oregon institutions and are feeling the pinch also. The specific situation that I'm in, we come up to a great deal of difficulty in placing our people from either acute care hospital setting or long-term rehabilitation hospital setting in their discharge setting. And we're having a much more difficult time finding appropriate settings for people. And I think one of the populations that's really difficult to place is the head injury population. because they really, most of the time, are not appropriate for a nursing home. And there is no big move, you know, to have any kind of an institution. And I don't think that's even appropriate for head injury.
Mm-mm.
But what is happening is that on occasion, people are getting together, and maybe a head injury foundation will be formed in a certain area. And they will get out like a halfway house kind of thing. It's a sheltered kind of living situation to help a head injured person move from the acute hospital setting into the community. And it takes a long time for them to do this. But here again, this is it just happens if maybe one family is very interested and gets the ball rolling, or maybe a little bit of money is found in a certain area, maybe one family will donate some money. It is not happening all across the nation. It's not happening all across our city, even.
Yeah, I think the functionally retarded, the adult onset injuries that cause a person to appear to be retarded, but you know they weren't in the developmental years, so they don't fit the definition. The definition of being mentally retarded is that you have a disorder that causes you to have less than normal abilities in a variety of areas, and I don't remember it completely, but it also has to occur before you are 18 or 21 years of age, depending on how people interpret that developmental years period. And so that group of people who are injured or ill or whatever happens to them over 18 or 21 and then appear to be retarded or functionally retarded, and usually that's from a head injury or a very severe illness, are one of the groups that falls in the crack.
Falls in the crack, for sure.
Yeah. Another group that falls in the crack are the mentally retarded, mentally ill, multiply disabled. There's just very, very limited settings for the person who has the diagnosis of mental retardation, but then has the additional problems of schizophrenia or one of the other mental illness kinds of things, because they don't fit anywhere.
We can commiserate for a long time, you know, on all of the sad situations for the kinds of clients that we work with. That doesn't really solve our problem. Mm-hmm. And our problem is a real bind of the change in federal funding for the programs that we have been used to, which were never adequate in the first place. State funds are drying up, especially SSI and, you know, welfare, mm-hmm. which of course federal, but welfare state. And there is nothing that is immediately coming forward to take its place.
Yeah.
I feel like it's that we're just really in a bind.
Yeah, and we really are, and I think one of the big things that people can do is keep the awareness before the community, in your churches, through your social ministry committees, or through other kinds of groups. Keep the people in the communities aware that these binds do occur, and that was part of the reason I wanted to do this session, was just to open up an awareness if somebody, you know, didn't have it. Just because the way we're going to have money, the way the dollars are going to keep coming, is that every time the legislation comes up to cut these kinds of services, if the legislators get enough letters saying, wait a minute, you know, there is this population out here, then they're going to be inclined to vote against it, or at least try to modify it by amendment. You just aren't going to get it if nobody says anything. And the problem is that, like I said before, the mentally retarded really don't have very good advocacy for themselves, because they can't write letters, and many of them, if they are state wards, cannot or do not vote. And so they aren't a very popular political population. But I think that if all of us who are concerned about mentally retarded and physically disabled and all of the other really disenfranchised populations, can say, listen, you know, my vote counts, and I'm not going to vote for people who are going to cut services. I'm not going to vote for the people who are going to vote against this kind of dollars and are going to vote for bombs and guns and you know, those kinds of things. And, but the legislators need to know that. And some of them are aware. A lot of them aren't.
If you could, you know, like have a big wish and sort of get a program going, I almost have a feeling, you know, that in the long run, to try to get away from federally financed programs is, in the long run, maybe a better idea, because always with the federally financed programs comes all the regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And the regulations can so bind you together, and as you've mentioned, many of them, you know, be really almost ridiculous. Sure, they were maybe the first time it was thought through that there's a certain regulation, no doorstops, you know, should be in any hospital. And perhaps that's a good regulation in the general, but there's always a specific situation where you're going to need a doorstop, and you don't want to have that detriment, you know, taken against you for having a doorstop in your hospital in one spot. It seems to me that there is a possibility for more fair and more judicious regulations if it's on a more state or local level. Have your own policing body, that kind of thing. But that's very idealistic. I don't know if it really would work.
I think one
have
of
you heard any
I don't
ideas
know.
For financing?
No. And, you know, I guess part of the problem is that if the states, if it was only the federal government that didn't have money right now, then going to state financing maybe would make some sense, and state regulations. The other thing is that there are some states that have really good services for physically disabled, mentally retarded, and elderly in residential settings. There are a lot of states that just don't have anything. A gal from my facility quit and went to Oklahoma for a year to work. And she thought, well, I'll see if I can get a job in a group home. They didn't know what a group home was in Oklahoma. They don't have such things. They don't have small community-based facilities. And she was in Tulsa. It's not exactly, you know, bohunk. Out in the country someplace, you know, it's not exactly this little tiny town of 10 people. It's a pretty good-sized city. They didn't know what a group home was. They just didn't have those kinds of services for retarded. They did have some services for mentally ill children and adolescents, but it was in a very large kind of setting. So, and that's the problem, I guess, with going statewide is that, you know, for each individual state is then there comes such a disparity of services. And so there's some advantages in the federal kinds of systems because at least, even though the federal regulations don't all make sense, at least they're applied in all of the states. And with the medical assistance money, that's partly federal and partly state, and usually, you know, it's a little bit better than some of the state funds, especially in some of the states that don't really have the commitment to social services. That's where I think the problem would come with state kinds of things. It would really be, you know, ideally, some of the situations that would be, you know, like when we were talking last night with Warner Jensen about the TCOA concept, and you know, to be able to have mentally retarded and physically disabled people living in home-like foster care type settings with other persons in some kind of a supportive community where they're contributing what they can uniquely contribute to that community. That would be, you know, an ideal kind of situation. I don't think that's ever going to solve our problem because there are certain populations of disabled and mentally, physically disabled and mentally retarded, who are so disabled that to live in a volunteer kind of setting just wouldn't work, because nobody could stand that 365-day, 24-hour-a-day type situation of caring for them in a residential setting, and probably always have to have some federal funding. But, you know, some of these other ideas are really good. Any other comments or questions or ideas?
We have thought about in our group was that there are a number of different ways that are cost efficient that are perhaps not always utilized. We're thinking of, let's say, rather than having a person in a full residential care setting, if he is possible, that you could go into a less heavy care setting, then it's more cost efficient to move that patient in or that client into that setting. But in order for them to do that, they would have to have, let's say, some kind of an income, you know, to do it. Mm-hmm. In the long run, it would be cheaper, because the heavy care nursing setting has to have everything on hand, you know, for an emergency with that patient. And maybe this higher level kind of patient would not need all the extra kinds of equipment available all the time, and yet they're still placed in that kind of setting, let's say because of behavior problems or because of some milder problem. That's the kind of setting you can find them in. So there are more cost-efficient ways of doing it, but you have to lay out new money in order to get them started.
Yeah. Another thing.
So by writing, by showing through studies, you know, that this kind of thing can be achieved, that's one way we can verify that or document that it's possible. And I don't think too much of that has been done.
No, there's a little bit being done, but not a real lot. Another thing that I think people, that can be done is to encourage the people who are doing the medical assistance kind of regulations to somehow differentiate between the poor who need medical assistance because their income is extremely low and they just need, you know, sort of basic medical care that all of us need, and the disabled who need medical care on a continuing basis whether or not they had an income. A lot of disabled people could work and earn an income. But they can't earn a big enough income to pay for their medical needs. If they earn too much, they can lose their medical assistance. It's just a vicious circle. And a lot of them, depending on how the regulations are written, they can go out and earn money, but they get no more discretionary income than if they sit in the nursing home or in the residence and collect just Social Security, medical assistance kind of money. They still get the $35 or maybe a little bit more so they can travel back and forth to work. Well, there's not a whole lot of incentive to go out and work 40 hours a week if you don't get any more discretionary income than what you had when you didn't work 40 hours a week. And so there's a lot of people who could hold down full or part-time jobs and make some money and help pay for some of their own expenses, and they should, if there was some way that they could have a little bit more discretionary income. I don't think that anybody should be able to make even, you know, maybe $10,000 or $15,000 a year and not contribute something toward, you know, and then get a free ride in terms of room and board and medical care and all of that, and have that money, you know, free. But on the other hand, I don't think they should be limited to, you know, what's it come out to be, $420 a year at $35 a month if they're working full time and, you know, paying toward their expenses. I think there's somehow there's got to be some balance in between. I don't have the answer to how to get it, but I think that the people who are writing the regulations have got to learn to look at mentally retarded, physically disabled, and elderly somehow different than the potential working poor, you know, the people who could work but are unemployed or you know, have young children or whatever, and you know, need the medical assistance that way. Somehow we've got to build some balance into that. I don't know what, I haven't figured out. I'm not smart enough to figure out that answer, I guess. But
what I'm hoping is that we're just in the throes of a big pendulum swing. I mean, you know, our nation always goes in big pendulums, doesn't go down the straight path. Now, for a long time, we had almost, for a while there, we had a pretty free hand with social services. And then when the budget really got out of hand, they started to bring it back into shape. What, in the long run, when we look back on it, you know, 10, 15 years from now, it may be that we will again come back and be able to provide the social services that are needed, but hopefully with some controls over poor discretion in handing it out to anybody, and those people who are using the system, you know, mm-hmm. well, they'll have some kind of controls that won't occur. But in the meantime, for the 10 or 15 years that it might take for this pendulum to swing back again, I see a lot of our people that we're working with right now really suffering.
Yeah. Right now, the facility that I work for is looking at needing, really having a strong need for at least three small group home kinds of settings. We have a population, we have 36 women in our residence and group home combined. Over half of them are over 50 years of age. They don't need nursing homes, but physically, if they get too disabled or too ill to be able to live in the non-accessible setting that we have with stairs and you know, all of those kinds of things, then the only option for them is a nursing home setting. What we'd like to be able to provide is a small group home for somewhere between 10 and 20 people in a couple of small units, or three small units, that would be physically accessible but not necessarily designed for wheelchair people. Wheelchair, it could be an intermittent possibility if somebody broke a hip or just, you know, really was having trouble walking or something like that. But we wouldn't be admitting people necessarily who were long-term wheelchair-bound kinds of people, but looking at homes for elderly, mentally retarded persons who need the specialized services for mentally retarded, but need some easier living settings in terms of the physical accessibility. We also have a small group of women who are both mentally retarded and have some pretty strong behavioral problems. They may be technically mentally ill and may not be, but they have a lot of acting out. In our larger setting with 30 people, they act out a lot. They get stimulated to act out a lot. They need a setting of 6 to 8 people. I think their behaviors would be reduced a great deal, or their negative behaviors at least would be reduced, and they'd be a lot happier, and so would all the staff. Then we also would like to be able to provide something in between our group home setting and the semi-independent setting, where they wouldn't have staff year-round, but I mean 24 hours a day, but something in between that, some kind of apartment training type setting or something like that. Right now there's a push in Minnesota to set up the funding for new facilities in a way that you have to have about a third of the startup costs down and with no prospect of recovering that. That puts nonprofit facilities like mine in a real bind. We don't have any way to raise the money in the first place, And once we raise it, we need to get it back so we can use it the next time. You can't go on raising $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 every year to start a new facility. You know, those kinds of dollars aren't out there to be donated for that kind of thing when, you know, the pressure is to donate dollars for food for the poor and for clothing for the poor and for, you know, all of these other things that need the donated dollar too. So I don't have any answers. I know all the questions. But I think that I guess the important thing is to really keep the issue in the forefront, have people aware of the issue, and have them, you know, writing letters to their congressmen, attending forums when the congressmen have them in their, you know, your areas, and bringing the issues up. And also, hopefully, for individuals to be volunteering too, you know, not just asking for federal dollars, but for people to be coming forth with the volunteer time and the volunteer dollars for these kinds of services. Are there any other questions or comments or anything? Well, that's all I have to say, I guess.